is somewhere far, far away.
Experience. Hey! Thank you. What a stadium full of people. And welcome to the Merry White House Experience, coming to you today from a basement in Broadcasting House. This is because our normal studios are out of action as the top two floors of the next door Ryman's exploded this morning. But never mind, the Dunkirk spirit is showing through, and there is a precedent for this. In 1963, a legendary event, the Goon Studio was flooded. They had to come down here and perform in front of an audience of six, and lo and behold, the show was crap, and it was the only one that never got broadcast. But to begin with, this is Punt and Dennis.
This week, we mourn a lost generation. It is difficult for us to conceive nowadays of the full horror of it. The appalling conditions, the mud, the constant pounding.
It is 20 years since Woodstock.
When it began, the whole thing seemed like a joke. Young people flocked to the recruiting stations.
Roll up, roll up. Now, twist the end and put it in your mouth.
Hundreds of thousands of them, unprepared for the horror that lay ahead, were issued with the standard kit. Caftans, purple bell-bottom loon pants, and the regulation gas masks necessary when 300,000 people are living entirely on chickpeas and lentils.
In those early days, no one took the thing seriously.
Yeah, I remember they were all saying that the drum solo would be over by Christmas.
But it wasn't. By mid-January, Santana were only halfway through their first song. Gradually, the ground became littered with comatose bodies.
It was decided to end the whole thing with a major offensive. A pair of flared trousers so hideous that even Joe Cocker wouldn't wear them.
Okay, Probeam, I want you to go over the top. Put on this pair of trousers. We need a big push. Then, just as it seemed as if it would go on forever, the campaign was brought to an end with the aid of a new and terrible apparition. The Zeppelin. Just the threat of having to sit through Stairway to Heaven was enough to bring even the most die-hard hippie to surrender.
It is fortunate for us that the hippies were stopped where they were. Otherwise, by now, they would have been running the country, in charge of huge areas of public policy, such as selling off the water and sewerage industries.
It's good shit, man. You've got a biker.
It's all part of the myth of the 60s. But now the Merry White House Experience wants to state clearly and unequivocally,
the 60s was a golden decade.
Fact. In the 60s, there were major wars in Vietnam, Biafra, and the Middle East. Nelson Mandela was imprisoned, Soviet tanks rolled into Czechoslovakia, and Matt and Luke Goss were born.
Conclusion, the 60s was a golden decade.
Fact. British motor engineering led the world with such timeless masterpieces as the Ford Zodiac, the Hillman Minx, and the Humber Peewit.
Conclusion, the 60s was a golden decade.
Man.
Fact. Widespread ownership of television saw the emergence of a highly paid generation of TV stars such as Jimmy Tarbuck, Bruce Forsyth, and Dickie Henderson. Conclusion,
Ken Dodd is innocent.
I hate to admit it, but last night I actually did something that I'm rather ashamed of. Last night I went to a fancy dress party. I'm not very good at those sort of dues. It always feels strange to be standing on your own in a room and thinking to yourself, I wonder if I can get a snog out of Mother Teresa of Calcutta. You know the sort of do. Accountants pretending to be gorillas, bankers pretending to be rabbits, and least believable of all, estate agents pretending to be members of the human race. There was one quite convincing costume, though. A useless piece of shit came as David Gower. The idea that fancy dress parties are good fun is one of the great misconceptions of our time. Along with every cloud has a silver lining, the royal family have worries like everyone else, and Lester Piggott was born lucky. One that I've always found slightly baffling is the claim, the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton. Now, this is actually one of a trilogy. The two slightly less well-known ones are that the Battle of Trafalgar was won at Harrow Swimming Baths And the Battle of Tressy was winning the Sittingbourne Middle School Windy House. I'd like to be put in charge of adapting these misconceptions so that they're more accurate. For instance, all Cockneys like a good sing-song should be all Cockneys smell of fish and try and sell you fruit all the time. Another one that is self-evidently untrue is blood is thicker than water. Now, whoever said that had never heard of Mike and Bernie Winters. Mike Winters was such a crap comic that his brother Bernie not only axed him from their double act, but replaced him with a German shepherd dog. Mind you, what Schnorbitz doesn't know is that he wasn't first choice. Bernie had originally tried to get Basil Brush, apparently. I actually dream about Basil Brush quite a lot, in fact. There's a particular one, right, where Basil and I both score twice for Stoke in the cup final. But we have our medals taken away on the grounds that he's a fox. Anyway, I bought a book to try and find out what my dream meant. And I looked up, achieving a great sporting triumph with a puppet. But it wasn't even in there. I can't understand it. What a waste of money. Anyway, I got to thinking that it was actually quite lucky that Martin Luther King isn't more like me, because he wouldn't be half as famous, would he, if he'd said, I have a dream. It's about this fox at Wembley.
And now, the Freemasonry experience, beginning with a short history of Freemasonry.
Freemasons like to believe that they are part of a tradition that stretches back to prehistory. Indeed, recent research has uncovered these tapes made in 60,000 BC.
Okay, Barney, roll up your left trouser leg and put on the apron.
I ain't got a trouser leg, Fred. I'm wearing a leopard skin bin liner.
Freemasons were originally groups of builders, and this still plays a part in its rituals today. The initiation ceremony at the Grand Order of Boaz in Pinner, for example, requires its new members to read the Daily Star, shout, "Whoa!" and wear trousers in such a way as to reveal at least 5 inches of buttock cleft.
Masonic incantations, which also have their roots in the craft of building, have remained secret for years by being spoken only in Latin. For example, the famous swearing-in oath.
Investito pendo magnum hymnatia verum dependo.
Which actually translates literally as, "Oh, put these joists in, flaming cowboys." The Masons are, of course, a notoriously difficult group to join. One man who failed to get in was Ronald Furbank.
Yes, well, I was up for indecently assaulting a sash window, actually, right? And I was convinced the judge was a Mason, so I thought I'd have a go at some of the signals, you know. Hit myself on the head, rise my knee, touch my ankle with my left hand, right? But I just ended up with an extra 6 months for impersonating a Bavarian slap dancer.
Now, what we'd like to know now is anybody in the audience a Mason? Right, well, the reason that I haven't got an answer here is not because there are no Masons here, but because Masons are not allowed to reveal themselves in public, despite the fact that they're always revealing themselves in private.
So what we're going to do now is play Hunt the Mason.
Now, the one thing that definitely gives away a Mason is that whenever he hears the word Boaz...
Apple strudel.
...he has to say the words apple strudel.
Oh, really? That is interesting.
But now, on with Hunt the Mason. Now, Masons can be quite difficult to spot because they are adept at blending in with the crowd. But we've narrowed the studio audience down to the two most likely candidates, who are the two men in the front row wearing enormous buffalo heads.
Now, this means one of two things. Either they're Masons or they're buffalo. So, sir, can I ask you how you would defend the charge that Masonry engenders nepotism? Oh, all right, you're a buffalo. But... you, sir, how would you answer the charge?
Moo! Moo!
Yes, well, sir, I don't think you're fooling anyone, but just to make sure, I've got a series of questions here designed to reveal your true identity. Now, if you were at an interview for the job of Chief Constable of Suffolk Police, would you A, fill out the form properly, taking care to use joined-up writing, B, raise your right hand to your left temple, or C, crap all over the floor and then migrate in a majestic horde to the prairies of Canada?
C.
Persistent bastard, aren't you? Boaz.
Apple strudel.
Oh, bugger.
Lastly, however, we would like to dispel the myth that the BBC is infested with Masons. After all, we've been able to put out this sketch criticising the... John Lennon once said that... in life, everyone has 15 minutes of fame. I think it was Andy Warhol who said... no, it was me who said that. But what Andy Warhol in fact said was that in life, everyone has 15 minutes on the log flume at Alton Towers.
Anyway, it's all rubbish because people who go on blockbusters often have up to 25 minutes of fame. Even longer if they get through 5 gold runs. Or even come back to do champion blockbusters. Anyway, there is one element in fame which unites us all. This song is about that. It's called I'm Not Famous, But I Know a Man Who Is. I promised myself this time would be different, and all through the meal I didn't even dare. Then someone mentioned they'd been to a party, and a newsreader from Border Television was there. And suddenly the gauntlet's down, the flags go up and the sirens sound. I try to hold it back but the words fade free. My dad went to school with Patrick Mower, the bloke out of Target, and what's my line as well? Everyone knows someone who's famous. Everyone's got some pathetic little anecdote to tell. My uncle's neighbours have a villa in Mallorca, next to Tony Arthur out of play school. And once in Bournemouth, I ended up French kissing with a girl who, it turned out, knew Neris Hughes. If I see two kids looking at the enemy, then I'll go across and start to talk about rock music just so I can say, my best friend's dad played squash with Bernie Flint, who said, I don't want to put a hold on you in 75. Because everyone knows someone who has been on Connections. Everyone's met Brian Cant at some point in their life. It's all the same like the Brat Pack in LA. All the beautiful people end up congregating round each other. Like the man from Martin Dawes who came to mend our television set, turned out to be the drummer on the Guys and Dolls tour of Saudi Arabia. Brother. And in the end, it's always the same with that same old downward spiral of claims to fame plummeting through the air. Down past Fred Dinage and meeting Rod from Brookside, to staying in a guest house when the Wurzels were there. But right down there at the bottom is a smiling face with brown hair and blue eyes. And she's smiling at me, she's calling, Tim, tell him about me. Yes! I shared a trampoline with Leslie Judd one Sunday morning at a gym displaying crew. And everyone goes quiet because now that makes me the someone they know who knows someone who is famous. I'll say again, my dad went to school with Patrick Mower. And I suppose for that moment, that one single moment, that makes me famous too.
Hello, Donna McPhail here. I'm in a bit of a bad mood, actually, to tell you the truth. I hardly got any sleep last night because of my downstairs neighbours. They were so noisy. They were making love so loudly I could hardly hear myself listen to them. And they woke me up last night in the middle of the night. I was really pissed off because I was staying at a friend's house across town. No, I'm talking loud here. This is not the discreet creaking of bedsprings, or the odd crack of the whip, which you can hear any night of the week round my way. No, this is, you can hear every intimacy. I mean, I feel involved. No, it's actually a threesome. I keep hoping they're going to call me up afterwards and say, how was it for you? To be honest, it's not actually their fault, because I live in a block of council flats. And in fact, the ceilings are so thin that when the people upstairs from me do the hoovering, my hair gets sucked up towards the ceiling. So I think the only thing to do is to provide a couple downstairs with a bit of competition. I mean, how do you go about finding a victim in a big city like that? It's not easy, is it, in London? So I actually thought of sending in an advert in the Lonely Heart section of Time Out. I even bothered working one out. It goes like this. Chain-smoking, meat-eating, bad-tempered bitch seeks like-minded git for boredom and sex. No, not very modest, really, is it? But then those adverts never are they? I mean, they're so squeaky clean. Everybody sounds so perfect. You can't help thinking, well, they're bound to be snapped up by now if there's not something wrong. You get the distinct impression they've left something out. Something rather important. Attractive male, tall, fair hair, blue eyes, seeks wonderful woman to help change colostomy bag. And they're always going on about how much money they've got in these adverts. It's a really big issue, you know. Own business, country cottage, Rolls Royce, small willy. That's what you're reading for, isn't it? As women get older, of course, they've got an additional problem because the old body clock's ticking away. And the pressure is on to make that big decision. Underwire bra or just run for the bus with your arms crossed? And of course, there's children. You've got to think of children. My mum's looking to me for grandchildren now. I've got a brother, but he doesn't want kids, which is fine by me because I wouldn't sleep with him anyway. No way, he's married. He got married 3 years ago to this woman called Mandy. When she's in the room and fart face when she's in the room. I can't stand her, none of us can. She's one of these women, she wears frilly collars and sensible shoes and does the washing up as she goes along, which is great Christmases. She's got this incredible talent of coming round to my house at a really bad time, like when I'm in. Anyway, this couple, my brother and his wife, they've decided not to have kids. They've decided not to because they're too fond of their cats. And apparently, I didn't know this, my brother told me this, it's actually very dangerous to have a baby in the house if you've got cats, because the baby could fall asleep on the cat's head and accidentally suffocate it.
This week sees the beginning of the new football season, and with it a goal-mouth scramble of TV anniversaries, 21 years of the big match, 25 years of match of the day, and 15 years since Elton Wellesby's haircut was fashionable. So we thought we'd take this opportunity to examine the impact of television on the game of football.
The commentator is probably the central figure that TV has brought to football. With the new creature came the new language. For example, in certain footballing phrases, the subjunctive might does not exist. So the phrase,
Bobby Robson's team might lose the next match,
is not possible. The correct form is,
Bobby Robson's team will lose the next match. TV commentators who all began in radio still relish the occasional opportunity to demonstrate that they haven't lost the skill.
Ro Kershaw, those are all back to Chumash. And I understand we've lost the picture, so I'll revert for a moment to radio commentary. And now the spinners with up, up and away.
One of the most familiar voices in TV football is the bloke who reads out the final scores on Grandstand. Earlier, I asked him how long he'd been doing this.
Years in the business, 47. Grandstand itself, 25.
Can I ask your opinion of John Inman?
I wouldn't say he's just the most effeminate man in the North, because he's Queen of the South, too.
The most important thing about TV from the footballer's point of view is, of course, the post-match interview.
And joining me on the touchline just out of the showers is Gary Stevens. Gary, the first thing I've noticed is you're covered in lather and you've been circumcised.
Yeah, well, the lads weren't very happy about me missing that open goal.
No doubt one day, however, post-match interviewers will have to face the prospect of a super-articulate footballer.
So, talk us through your first goal.
Well, as soon as the ball came over from the wing, I knew that it was no ordinary ball. The word Adidas seemed to fade from it. This was not a ball anymore, but the ball. Fussball in the sense that Wittgenstein might have used it. And from that point on, my passage towards goal had an almost organic coherence, solipsistic in its universality. So I looked up, saw the space, and slotted it in.
Thank you very much, Vinnie Jones.
But whatever additions television brings to the game, we can be sure that football will always remain the world's number one sport, because it is the game that everyone can play. Kids in Carlisle, peasants in Rio de Janeiro, prisoners in Wormwood Scrubs, everyone, it seems, except the England team. Good night.
Now, this week has seen once again renewed controversy over the question of the Sunday trading laws, with the fining last week of certain DIY stores for Sunday opening. Now, at this point, we have to be very careful, since religion is one of the subjects that guarantees that we will get complaints. The four things that most offend radio listeners are jokes involving religion, the Conservative Party, bad language, or the royal family. Now, in order to get round this, we've devised a special sketch that will guarantee to offend as many of those people as possible.
Hello, St. Peter. We noticed that Jesus hasn't registered for poll tax.
Piss off, you toadying right-wing prat.
All right, but at least I'm not as thick as Princess Diana.
Right, so, Sunday trading. The crux of the dispute over allowing shops to open on Sunday is that it says in the Bible that on the Sabbath you should do no work. Now, the only shops open on Sundays are DIY superstores. Since when have you ever seen anyone working in a DIY superstore?
When the Bible says you shall do no work, it doesn't specify whether this means paid work or just any active use of time. If the Ten Commandments had included, thou shalt not make an almighty mess trying to replumb thine own bathroom to save a few, Bob, it would be much clearer. Now, if we carry on disobeying the Bible like this, will some awful punishment be sent upon us?
And it came to pass that he looked down upon the world he had created, and he saw that on the Sabbath, lo, there was much mowing of lawns, much purchasing of barbecue sets, and much washing of Vauxhall Novas. And he saw that it was not good. But there was one among them who did no work on the Sabbath, for lo, he would sit around and watch the EastEnders omnibus. And lo, his name was Noah, and he was spoken unto in a great voice, saying,
Noah, thou hast not disobeyed my commandment, and therefore I advise you to build an ark, 200 cubits by 80 cubits, all of oak and cedar wood.
And Noah replied, saying, Crikey, I'll have to nip down to Sainsbury's home base to get some corner brackets and a new hammer. And the Lord said,
Oh, forget it. Just don't book your next holidays at Butlin's in North Wales.
What is the strange grudge that the Lord's Day Observance Society have against DIY enthusiasts?
After all, Jesus himself was a carpenter, and if Texas Home Care had existed in the first century Judea, just ask for Doubting Tom, he would have been quite free to buy his rule plugs there, since the Jewish Sabbath was on a Saturday anyway.
Right, now it's time for the punchline experience. Before the show, the studio audience were asked to write a punchline to the following sentence. What did the Director General say when he heard the explosion that put the BBC studios out of action? I've got all the answers collected here on some bits of paper, and the best one will win a prize, ownership of Ryman's. I've actually got it here in this cup. Right, so here we go. What did the Director General say when he heard the explosion that put the BBC studios out of action? Bugger, I thought we'd sorted out the internal BBC pay dispute. Yes, that's from Ian Prosser, whose name is Cockney Rhyming Slang, I think. What did the Director General say when he heard the expression that put the BBC studios out of action? So that's where Salman Rushdie was hiding. That's from Richard Killiver, I think, and I like that one. It was a good one. Richard Killiver getting a laugh by itself there. Such a funny man. What's on Channel 4? Right? Okay. And that's from someone who's educationally subnormal, ladies and gentlemen. Effing hell, the building has just exploded. Yeah, once again, the person who hasn't really understood the concept of comedy. Every week they turn out is another one. Now, I'm just going to read out the name here, right? And the name is Annoyed, because that bastard, David Baddiel, hardly ever reads my punchlines out. See, I haven't done it again, you see. That was a clever joke for me, but it didn't really work. Trites, what a big one, Vicar. Kenneth Connor. I read that one out quickly because I thought it wasn't going to get a laugh, but it has. But I'm not going to give it because I thought the best one was the one by Richard, funny name, Killiver. Big round of applause, ladies and gentlemen.
The Mary White House Experience.
And now, once again, it's time to play the Dungeons & Dragons Interactive Audience Participation Fantasy Adventure Experience. Last week, our hero, played by Nick here.
Hello.
Hello, Nick. Found his way through the Forest of Peril in his quest to find the stolen dragon sword of Trollsbane and thus earn a Community Action Trust reward. This week he must find his way into the Crag Fortress of Eternal Darkness.
Sounds pretty hairy.
Yes, indeed, Nick. Okay, let's go.
Long, long ago, in a distant time.
Oh, no, 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 not again. Not again. Can we have a different voice this week, please?
Are you sure?
Yes, I think we've done this one, quite frankly.
Can I do my Frank Spencer?
No, you can't do your bloody Frank Spencer.
Long, long ago.
No! You are not doing Frank Spencer, all right?
How about Dennis Healy?
No! Just get on with it.
Long, long ago in a distant time, there lived a ferocious dragon beast of doom.
That'll do.
it's quite enough. Right, okay, we're off. Now, Nick, you are about to advance towards the fortress when suddenly you are confronted by a group of those male witches.
Warlocks.
No, it's true. They're standing there. And their leader asks you a question.
Now, Nick, before you try and enter the fortress, you're allowed to choose one companion to take with you. Who do you choose?
Him.
Oh, no. Yes, it's Richard Killiver, ladies and gentlemen. You'll have to come with me, Richard. Oh, Kilner. Right, I'm dyslexic, I'm sorry. Nick is elected to take with him as his companion the mighty warrior they call Richard Kilner, who's wearing a Costa del Sol t-shirt, listeners. Extraordinary. Apparently that is the uniform of the mighty warrior. Right. First of all, the two of you must cross. Come with me. First of all, the two of you must cross the River of Serpents. To do this, you find one of those sort of circular boats made out of reeds.
Coracle.
No, it's true. And in it, you cross the river and reach the fortress. But before you can gain entry, you must pass the gate. And the gate is guarded by a fearsome creature, the three-headed Coleman monster.
That is
extraordinary.
You must answer the question.
What happened next?
Right. So there it is, right? You're in front of the fortress, Richard. The Colwyn monster has asked you the question. Richard, what happens next? Come on, Richard, what happens next?
Repeat the question.
Well, what happens next? What is that you want? There's only three heads there. Oh, dear. What happens next?
I'll talk my way out of it, basically.
You talk your way out of it, basically. I'm sorry, but you've got it wrong, and thus you find yourself taken to the dungeon and chained to the wall using those sort of wrist things.
Manacles.
No, it's true. Anyway, you look round in the dungeon for help, but there's only a figure weeping quietly in the corner. It's Steve Ovette. What's he doing here? He's upset because we didn't write a whole sketch about him, but just stuck him in this one as a topical reference. However, it gives you an idea, and you offer the guard £20,000 to let you run for it. You escape, but they spotted you and give chase. The guards are closing in, the walls are solid stone, there's no escape, and then you have a brilliant idea, Richard. You have a brilliant idea.
I'm not Salman Rushdie.
Yes. Don't tell me you're the ideas man at Saatchi & Saatchi.
I'm sorry, it's wrong, actually, because the answer should have been that he would remain completely silent and not tell them anything, as you're about to be interrogated by a feared and a ruthless questioner.
Yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen. Now, it's the end. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Fair enough. Okay, anyway, it's the end. We're coming to the end of my run on Wogan, and my last guests here in the studio are very different guests indeed from the others. For a start, they aren't personal friends of mine. And secondly, it's a matter of life and death. Yes, indeed, will they survive my ruthless interrogation? In time for next week for another episode of The Greatest Fantasy since Nigel Lawson's Economic Forecast. I think I'm getting the hang of this.
Bollocks.
No, it's true. My name's Ben Allen, and good night.
And finally tonight, a special message to those who have bought tickets to see Bross at Wembley Stadium tomorrow afternoon. If you head for Wembley Park Tube Station for about 12:30, I'll give the four of you a lift. Thank you. Good night. You've been listening to The Merry White House Experience. It was written and performed by David Baddiel, Rob Newman, Steve Punt, Hugh Dennis, Nick Hancock, Donna McPhail and Tim Firth. The production system was Viv Drew, the sound was by Sue Templeman, the producer was Harry Thompson, and many thanks to the fat bastard with a beard for not turning up.